My name is Rick Cheddar, and this is From Radioland.
Season 3 From Radioland, yep, and it's a big one, too. No, not really. Well, actually, no. I kid. There's kind of a neat little thing I've got going on here for season 3 for those of you that are subscribers to this podcast. Thank you, first of all, so very much for being a part of it. We've had a great, 25 episodes, 26 episodes, whatever. Who's counting, right? But I wanted to get into this a little bit differently. I mean, it's far too long to have put all this aside. And for our third season here from Radioland, I wanted to get into the whole bad dog thing. I know I've been teasing it. It's going to happen, I promise you, because here's how we're going to do it. We're going to do it in three parts. It's a big story, and there's a lot that has to be told to go with it. So allow me, dear listener, to do that in these three parts. Now, here's the thing. You can go ahead and consider this part one of this little mini-series regarding the whole story about what happened and what led me to my current situation at Radio Memphis and the things that we are doing, differently, of course, and the things that we have in place are certainly not entirely by accident. It is sort of by design, but there was an accidental situation that occurred, if you really want to call it accidental, regarding certain individuals and people that I'd worked with and people that I was very close to, that had changed the fortunes of others and thereby changed the way we all operated and did our thing. Having said all that, we'll get to it, I promise you, over the next 3 weeks, starting with this episode here. Bless you. Some guy sneezed. Just for a point of reference, I'm back in the park. The reason being, Doug's in the studio laying down some guitar tracks. Yeah, it's all right. It's a long story, but studio equipment is still acting strange. We are in the process of sorting that out. And the next two episodes, which will be, actually, believe it or not, will be recorded at the same time. We've decided that would be the best way to make that happen. And it would just be easier on everybody if we did it in that fashion. It's going to be a bit difficult at me for times to explain it all. I will do my best with that. There won't be any visual aids. There won't be any reference audio. There won't be any official record from history regarding all of this, of which I'm about to tell you, starting here. It's just that there was so much that happened and so many difficult things that occurred, especially toward the end, that it's high time that we start laying them down. Now, keep in mind something. It wasn't all, piss and vinegar. There were a lot of great things that occurred and a lot of wonderful people that I encountered along the way. And I'm not going to lie to you, the process by which I'm going to go through over the next 3 weeks is not going to be entirely easy. It is going to be difficult. I'm going to have to be walking through some fairly dark doors. Having not recorded the second and third installments of this particular story yet, I've already had a talk with a couple of folks who wanted to be a part of it as far as being in the room. I have decided that I will be doing those episodes solo. They will be by myself. Now, whether or not there's actually going to be somebody in the room with me, that's yet to be seen. I might not. I do know this, that there will be a bottle of George Dickel whiskey involved. So it's going to have to come to that because there were some tough things. And when people ask me about what all had happened at Clear Channel and everything that was, surrounding that whole environment and what that was like, you have to keep in mind something. none of it was easy, especially at the end. There were so many scenarios that had played out, first in our heads and then in reality, that a lot of it was just unfathomable. You know what I'm saying? Some things that would happen that you would never believe would be a thing. So bear with me as I go through this. Some of the dates, not entirely 100% accurate because I didn't take copious notes while it was going on. Having lived it was a bit of enough, and it was a bit of a nightmare. It was a great dream that turned horrible. For some, others, it was far worse. And it was a very unique part of history. This will be the final word on all of this. This will be what I reference to when people ask me about it. When people, and they will come, they will ask, what the hell happened? They've done it for years, since we're about 3.5-4 years into what actually occurred. And I try and tell them the story as best as I can without getting too morose about it. Some of the things that I, some of the anecdotes and some of the stories that have occurred and that I relate to these people, they tend to find themselves in a little bit of shock. They don't quite believe that this thing could actually happen in such an innocent and freeing business as the broadcast business. That is completely tongue-in-cheek and completely sarcastic. I will do my best to keep the mood as light as possible. It's not easy. So, this first episode here is about my first time. My first time being on the radio. Well, not really being on the radio. It's about my first time being in a radio station. It's really actually more like it. A lot of us that have been in this business have very similar stories. Mine's probably not all that remarkable. In fact, I don't really think of it as being all that remarkable. I was an impressionable young 18-year-old, I guess. It was 30 years ago. A long time ago, actually. A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Actually, no, it was in San Antonio, Texas. There was a radio station that was kind of an easy listening, quasi soft rock jazz station down there. And there was an overnight girl that used to be on the air there. And for some bizarre reason, I felt compelled to call this woman on the request line and said, look, I'm fascinated by what you do. I'd love to come see the station sometime, thinking that I might get a tour of the place. Well, boy, howdy did I. It was New Year's Eve that year, and I was, of course, living at home, and my folks were going out to a New Year's Eve party. I was cut loose upon the streets, given the explicit instructions not to get too fucked up and drive, which I actually obeyed them. And I drove over to this radio station, which sat on the top of a hill. If you're familiar with the song, the Doobie Brothers song, China Grove, it's about a little spot in San Antonio that sits on top of a hill there called China Grove. And there was this station. I don't even think it's on the air anymore. And for the life of me, I can't remember the call letters. But I do remember the young lady that was on the air at the time. Her name was Mara. I'm not going to mention her last name because I don't know if she's still in the business or if she's even still alive for that matter. It was a long time ago. Mara was a lovely lady and, a seasoned pro in my eyes at that time. And here comes this, gangly 18-year-old kid beating on the back door of this radio station. You know, this is back in the day when, records were involved. The CD was actually starting to become a little bit more of a thing. And so my hat's off to this woman. I mean, she could have been letting in an idiot into this. Well, she kind of did. But she could have been, letting some crazed animal into the radio station. And she chose to, I guess, trust her gut on this thing and gave me a tour. I was impressed by it. And obviously, it impressed me tremendously because I wound up making my home business, my home enterprise, exactly the broadcasting business. Various shapes and form, mind you, but that's what I did. The studio was kind of a round room. It had glass on one side that looked into the office. But oddly enough, when the jock was sitting at the control board, you know, the console, their back would be to that glass. So you always had that omnipresent feeling that somebody was looking at you over your shoulder, which is, you know, can be unnerving. So, you know, you just do your thing. Adjacent to that, room was the library, which was, you know, probably about a third of the size of the studio and had narrow little aisles and LP records, alphabetical order by artist. And they were all taped up, which meant that the ends of the, you know, the cardboard ends, you know, three sides were taped up. So you know, they get tired after a while and they get fragmented. So you got to fix it and make it work. And there would be a card that you'd tape to the back of the LP that told the jock which records were acceptable to play on the station and whatnot. So that was there. And Mara was sitting there at the board. And it was my first experience with watching a jock do her thing on air with a thumb-controlled board. She cue up the record to be able to trigger him with her thumb. I thought it was awesome. Instant speed turntables. It was the shit. It was wonderful. And man, I was hooked. Both of us had a visitor about an hour later after I got there, and it was her boss, the program director. He came wandering in. And we're thinking, oh, goodness, now we're in trouble. Not so much, actually. It was him looking for a fine time on a New Year's Eve. And he brought it with him in the form of a fifth of vodka. Now, this guy is one of those guys that has the ability to grow a beard just by thinking about it. You know, one of those really, truly hirsute individuals. He grunts large enough and a beard magically appears. I say that because over the course of about 4 hours that I was there, I watched this man's beard grow. It was quite impressive. But anyway, the three of us had a large time. We talked about the business. He did his best to dissuade me from getting into the radio business, as a lot of guys will tell you. There's always somebody that says, you really don't want to get into this. And if you persevere, of course, you do wind up in situations that I have been placed in over the years, of which I will expand upon. But over time, you know, it had come back, I guess, in a way to haunt me that I had didn't take this man's advice, because I find myself telling youngsters that come to me and say, hey, what can I do to get into the radio business? And I tell them quite simply, run as far away as you can, run as fast as you can, and stay out. It'll suck you in, and it'll mess you up. That was the advice I was given then. And it's probably a little more true now than it was then. It's not a very glamorous job, at least for those of us that are in it. It seems that way at times. There's a bit of celebrity that comes with that, I guess, notoriety, which, you know, for good or ill, that's the way it is. And I ignored his advice and stuck it out. We fast forward a little bit. I wind up going to the University of Texas at San Antonio as a geology major because my family thought it would be best that I not even entertain the idea of getting into the entertainment business. See what I did there? After failing miserably in science classes, I came to the ultimate conclusion that the world had enough scientists and they didn't need some idiot like me in there to mess everything up. So I went on and I wound up going to a community college after I'd failed out of UTSA. Oh, man, I was on probation after my first semester. After the second semester, it was like, dude, really? You are so not suited for this. So I went to take, you know, the remedial stuff, English, history, math, that kind of stuff. And I figured, well, let me see what I can do and kind of figure out my life, you know, get my shit together, as it were. A lot of us have gone through that. A lot of you probably went through the same thing. I was in the arts building at the San Antonio Community College on San Pedro Boulevard. I don't even know if the thing is still there. I'm sure it is. It's there across from the San Antonio Little Theater, or SALT, as it were, kind of in close to the downtown area. And I'm sitting in the arts building one day, and there was a quiet hallway that had these benches there, and there was on one side it was all glass. It looked out into a courtyard. And in between classes, when I had, there was a couple of days of the week, there was a gap of like a 2 hour gap between classes. And I would go to this spot because very few people were in the arts building, understandably so, because they were smart and said, you know, we're not getting into the arts. And I would sit there and study. And up against my back was the wall that led, in a doorway that led to KSYM FM 89.3, or 90.1. That's what it was, 90.1. I don't know why I said 89.3. 90.1. KSYM. We used to call it KSNM. And a friend of mine that I knew back from high school was a student at San Antonio Community College, at SAC. SAC. And he was a DJ on the campus radio station owned by the college and run by the students. And he said, yeah, come on and take a look, you know. So I looked around and said, man, I remember being in a station, you know, a couple of years before. And he said, man, this is a lot of fun. We get to do this. We have this type of thing. It's a real radio station. You have to learn the FCC stuff, and you got to learn how to deal with the transmitter, and you got to learn how to play with the logs, and you got to spin records, and you're slip queuing. And the classes seemed like a lot of fun. I wound up talking to the – pardon me, I'm looking at the recorder. Hold on. I wound up talking to the dean of the college, and he suggested to me that I give it a shot. And so the next semester, I enrolled in radio, television, film courses. My family wasn't too terribly pleased with that, but at least part of they were just happy, I think, at this point for me to find something that I felt like I could do. There was probably some disappointment. You got to remember, too, that SAC, San Antonio Community College at the time, was very famous for its mortuary program. You could get an associate's degree in mortuary science. Dude, I did not want to go that route. You know, nothing against the industry. People die. I get it. It's sad, and it's a business that continues to be much viable. But I'm not going to go that route. So anyway, I'm in the radio, television, film department, and I'm dealing with a professor by the name of Don Phillips. I don't know that Don is still around anymore. Don was a guy that sat me down in his office one time, and he said, so why do you want to get into this this business? I said, I don't really know why. I just feel like I belong in it. I want to do it. At least I'm going to give it a shot and see if it's something that would be worth getting into. And, of course, he gave me all the warnings and stuff of how, you know, effed up the business is. And, you know, you don't ever expect to make a big pile of money doing it. You know, you be prepared to move a lot. You're gonna work in one town for 3 or 4 years and wind up moving into another, and such as that. And still undaunted, I was under the mindset that I should at least, you know, continue to give this a try. So they put me on the air, and I wound up picking up a couple of little shifts at KSYM. And one of them was, since they couldn't get anybody else to do it, was actually morning drive, which was really a trip. And I was having to be on the air, I think it was 8 to 10, I think it was, something like that. It was just 2-hour shifts, and it was all classical music, which is just a real downer. But it was an experience. It was a lot of great fun, and I was learning production at the time and just really starting to let the business grow on me. And during the course of that time, a couple of guys that had been working at that radio station were saying that, you know, we all have jobs in the actual broadcast industry. We have paying jobs in the broadcast industry while we're still in school. And I said, well, where are you working? Well, a couple of these guys were working at the NBC affiliate in San Antonio, KMOL TV Channel 4. And through their kindness, their benevolence, and a good word from them, I wound up getting a part-time job as a camera jockey for the 6 and 10 p.m. news. Ultimately, I wound up progressing through that business, becoming a floor director and then eventually the actual technical director. I got to push the buttons that made all the cameras go onto the air. That was big fun. I enjoyed the hell out of that. And while I was studying, you know, this stuff in school, I started to become a little more attracted to the television industry in that there were so many moving parts and it was fun and it was really a nifty environment. So I began to walk away from the radio industry and get into more of the television end of it. And at that time, right around the same time, after a couple of years at the community college, I moved to Texas Lutheran University. Actually, it was Texas Lutheran College, or also known as TLC, which is a running gag. And by God, I could do episode upon episode of that place. And they had a communications program there that was a four-year deal. So TLC at the time, 30 minutes east of San Antonio, 35 minutes east of San Antonio, in a little town called Seguin, Texas. Their big claim to fame was that Vern Lundquist was a graduate over there. Of course, at last I checked, Vern didn't have too many kind things to say about that place. Quite frankly, neither do I. But that's regardless of anything. So had a nice apartment there. I didn't want to live on campus because they wouldn't let you drink on campus. You know how it goes. And I was studying there, and then I was working almost full-time at KMOL while I was in school doing the newscast. And studied under some of the reporters, and a fine man, a very wonderful human being by the name of Alan Hemberger. Alan was the anchor of the 5, 6, and 10 o'clock news, Vietnam War vet, a very wild and fun sense of humor. He is a guy that would often sit me down and say, look, you know, I think you got the, it's just shocking to hear this, I think you have the look for television, and you certainly have the voice for it. Why don't you get a shot as doing some reporting? So to put something together, I volunteered my time on the weekends. On Friday and Saturday nights, I would ride with an overnight photographer, and we would chase news stories by just listening to the scanner, and we'd hear there was a shooting somewhere, or there was a fire, or they found a dead body somewhere, and away we would go, and I would get to put together these stories just for practice, and I would learn how to edit videotape and learn how to write news, and through the guidance of these people. It was great on-the-job training. It was stuff that you couldn't get in any college. The old adage that people in college, the instructors there, are people who just failed in the industry, is really kind of true. My apologies to those who are educators in higher education facilities. But the saying that it goes, those who can do, those who can't teach. It was kind of true, especially since there was a professor at the Texas Lutheran College by the name of Dan Mathis. Dan was a bastard. Dan was a misogynistic, male chauvinist, drunken whoremonger. Yeah, I said it. He also had me teach a class for him since he was usually too hungover to deal with it, and managed to prove myself in exchange for a college credit for taking the class. He had me teach the damn thing since I was actually working in the industry. A funny aside, there was a class that he was teaching that I was in, and it was another ethics type of ethics and journalism class of some sort, and he was busting my balls over something. And in fact, I don't even remember specifically what it was, but that's not the point. The point of the story is that in the middle of the class, he singles me out, and he says, well, Mr. Cheddar, what did you think of that? And I said, I think it sucks, and I think you suck. Oh my God, it was as if I had kicked him in the balls. He couldn't handle the fact that I called him out and I thought that he sucked. So he calls me into his office. He sits me down and he begins to chew me out, and he's about to tell me he's going to wash me out of the entire program at the college, and that there was going to be hell to pay unless I stood in front of his class and apologized. I said, all right, I will. If that's what keeps me around, I will. So I stood in front of the class the next time we met, which was that following Wednesday or Friday, whatever day it was. And I said, listen, I said the other day, when asked about a particular situation, I thought it sucked, and I thought that the professor sucks. And I'm here to apologize to that for those of you who might have been offended, because I was told, of course, that there were students that were offended, not just Dan Mathis, because Dan was an egotistical dickhead. But I said, my apologies to those of you who I have offended. And of course, everybody in the room is snickering because nobody was offended by what I said. And I said, and if y'all don't accept my apology, if you don't think that that I'm not deserving of this, well, I think y'all suck too. And I went and sat down, and I could see Mathis, his face getting just red. He had this kind of a fat face. I mean, he sometimes when I look at the full moon at night, it reminds me of that bastard. Any rate, he threatens to wash me out of the whole thing. And I hold it over his head when I go to his boss, and his boss finds out that I'm actually teaching one of his classes for college credit. Dan, I believe, was threatening me with all sorts of trouble. Long story short, there was threats of lawsuits and shit. And any rate, I think he wound up losing his job, or at least getting suspended over the whole disaster. I wound up moving along, and life is happy. But back to the story. So I'm working for KMOL Television at the time, and I'm learning my chops. You know, this is the minor leagues for me. I mean, even though I'm working in a major market television station, it's still minor leagues because I'm only getting to do the things that I'm, you know, allowed to do. It's just, you know, hell, I'm 21 at this point. And I'm working as a director of newscasts. I'm working as a part-time writer for the news a little bit. Made some wonderful friends. To this day, KMOL has a reunion of all of their employees down in San Antonio. In fact, just I guess it's been since May or June, they were planning a big reunion, the reunion of all the employees. And, you know, they were passing these messages around on Facebook, and unfortunately I was unable to go. I would have liked to. It would have been a lot of fun. They were all meeting at some Mexican restaurant and doing what TV people do, which is drink an enormous amount of alcohol and eat a lot of free food. So I didn't get to go, but they'll do it again, and someday I'll show my face around those folks again. All right, so it came to the point where I was done with college, and it was time to move on in my career. And I had put together a resume tape of the things that I had accomplished at KMOL Television, you know, the stuff I was doing with the overnight reporting. And I wound up submitting my tape to several television stations across the country, and I got a really solid offer from WTVA in Tupelo, Mississippi, Channel 9. I was hired to be at that time what they considered a bureau reporter, which was a guy that was actually living in Columbus, Mississippi, which was, what, about an hour and a half south of Tupelo, down in the Golden Triangle of Columbus, West Point, and Starkville, babe. And every night they would have this uplink type of thing, and I would be sitting on this little set, and it was tiny, it was like a phone booth, and I would give the news from the Golden Triangle for, you know, whatever story that they had us do. And it was, oh, it was small market TV. It was fun. It was great fun. I miss those days. It was very innocent, and we had such a large time. And that's where I, well, before I get to that. So I spend about a year down there, and I get promoted to move to Tupelo to become the weekend anchor and do reporting during the week. Well, hot damn, I'm thrilled about that. I get to move from one tiny little town to a slightly larger little town. Tupelo is a wonderful town. We did have a ball. It's North Mississippi. You can't go wrong with North Mississippi, folks. So I move up there and commence my new job. And being a reporter and the weekend news guy with, there was Wayne Herford that was doing news as well. There was John DeLusic, who's still there. He's still a meteorologist there. He still does the weather for them. And then there was Eric Perkins, who was doing sports, at the time. Eric's father used to host a show on A&E. It was like he used to do biography and stuff. And for the life of me, I can't think of his first name, but he was a very well-known journalist. But at any rate, we're all working together. We're doing the news and we're just having a large time. And it was right about that point that I met my good friend Tom Dees, who is now here in Memphis at WHBQ, Fox 13. He's an on-air reporter here. But at the time, he was a photographer. And by God, we all had some great times. And worked with a producer by the name of Robert Davidson, Kathy Blaze, Terry Smith was the news director at the time. It was just a wonderful experience, and it was a small, simple operation. You know, I wasn't making a whole hell of a lot of money. Hell, I wasn't making probably $16,000 a year. And ultimately, I get promoted to the 10 p.m. newscast. Terry was tired of doing the late thing, and they wanted to move me in to anchor the 10 p.m. with the co-anchor by the name of Kathy Coggins. Kathy is a lovely lady. We had a lot of laughs together. We wound up sharing an office together there, and Kathy was really funny. She was unlike a lot of women in television who was in it for their own glory. Kathy was in it because it was a decent paying job. At least at the time, her husband, whose government name is Bubba, no joke, was a plumber, a very well-known plumber in Tupelo. But fantastic time. And right about the time I felt as if I had reached the peak of my career arc there at WTVA, I received a mysterious phone call one night at my desk, and it was from a guy who was a headhunter. I don't even remember his name, but he was out scoping for television talent for a television station in Topeka, Kansas. And he was at a hotel in Tupelo and had seen me and wanted to talk to me, and we went to this bar. And I was presented with a contract right there on the spot to move to KTKA Television in Topeka, Kansas, channel 49 on the UHF dial. It sounds ridiculous that there would be viable stations up there, but I mean, it's far up on that band like that, but it was very legitimate. They were the ABC affiliate. So this began one of the biggest mistakes I ever made in this business, and that was take the job sight unseen. They wouldn't bring me in for an interview up there. It was all done down here, and the money was good, and it was a 3-year deal to anchor the 6 and 10 o'clock news. So up I went, packed up, and said my goodbyes to all my friends in Tupelo. At one point while I was in Topeka, they all actually kind of came up and paid me a visit, which was damn nice. And when I got there, I began to realize that perhaps I'd made a mistake. Things just didn't feel right. I'm not going to expand on too much of it, but my co-anchor at the time was a woman by the name of Anita Reese. And for some bizarre reason, the woman hated me. I think because she had a thing with the guy that I had replaced. They had been buddies. I don't know to what extent. But they were friends, and they booted him out, and they brought me in. And thus, that probably created some type of friction there. It wasn't necessarily my fault. I probably didn't do anything to smooth it over because, you know, I was an arrogant, sexy television star, by God. Probably so. I was young and full of scotch, and, you know, I was the next Tom Brokaw, and y'all were going to deal with it whether you liked it or not. All right, so I signed a 3-year deal. 6 months into it, the owners of KTKA Television decide that the television news department could not fund itself anymore because of whether they couldn't sell it or whatever the problem was. So they blew out the sales. They blew out the local reporters and anchors. And there's an old saying in television that Alan once told me, because I called him for advice when that happened. And he said, a television station and a ship have a lot in common. When they're both sinking, it is the anchors that are the first to go over the side. That's what happened. Trying to be the trooper, I hung in there in Topeka as long as I could. I tried like hell to get a job anywhere. I couldn't go back to WTVA. My position had been filled. I had to look elsewhere. It got bad, folks. I descended into probably the earliest part of my madness. I was drinking uncontrollably. I was putting away a fifth of J&B scotch nearly a night. The only reason why I survived that, or how I was able to survive it, was the fact that I was probably quite young. About a year went by and nothing was happening. There was nothing I could do. I even had an agent at the time. His name escapes me at the moment, but he couldn't do anything for me either. It was one of the first early recessions in, was it the early 90s? I guess all this, 93, 94, 91, 92, 93, somewhere in there, where the television business started taking it on the chin. And there was a drunken moment I do remember. I wrote a letter to Tom Brokaw at NBC. don't ask me why, but I did. He wrote back to me. I still have the card. It says, I wish I could help, Rick, but times are tough all over. Good luck. All best. Signed, Tom Brokaw. It was actually, you know, kind of cool. So I became that guy. You know, that guy who moves back in with his parents. That guy with no future. That guy who had to explain to his mother and father why they were right that I had no business getting into the entertainment business. And that guy who was stuck living in the same room that I was in when I was in high school. What the hell was I going to do? I got out of the business is what I did. 6 years I was out. Did a variety of things. I kind of kept my hand in the business. I wound up taking a part-time fill-in job as a traffic reporter for, oh God, what was it called? Total Traffic? I think it was Total Traffic. It's through Westwood One, I believe. Anyway, they would call me when they needed somebody to fill in, and I would get up and work this horrible shift. It was a split shift. You're up at 4:00 in the morning, you work till 10:00, you go home, you got to be back at 3:00 in the afternoon. You're doing the traffic reports and that stuff. And people would go on vacation, and I would have to go to their studios, and we would bounce between stations and do traffic reports, and you'd have to have different names. I think on one station I was known as Juan Valdez. Crazy stuff. So one of the highlights to that was I got to be the guy in the sky. And I got to do it quite a bit, actually. Would get to the airport at 4:00 in the morning. I was in a helicopter by 4:30. And we would be over the city till about 9:30. And then we would land, and I would go back later in the afternoon, and we'd get in a fixed-wing plane, and we would take off at about 4:00, and I would be back down by 6:00, something like that. And we had a good time with that. It was a bit harrowing at times. I once got into a helicopter And, of course, helicopters fly under what is called VFR, which is visual flight rules. And if there's any type of fog or anything, you don't want to be in a helicopter. A helicopter is a squirrely device. You don't really think the thing should fly. It has like 800 moving parts to it. One of them fails, you're done. And I rode with a guy once, and I get out to the tarmac, and it's kind of foggy. Not horrible, but it was enough to make me kind of nervous. And the guy that was the pilot was a former helicopter airlift guy in Vietnam, and he was, you know, doing his part time flying the traffic thing. We were in a Bell Jet Ranger. I was in the back seat. He was up front, of course. As I had what is called a MARTI equipment, MARTI, out of MARTI, Texas. It was a sort of a funky microwave transmitter. And the thing was huge. It was like as big as a big suitcase. And it would sit next to me in this helicopter. And I grab a cup of coffee and I'm headed out there. And I've got this thing over my shoulder. And I get in, I get hooked up. And away we would go. But on this particular morning, it was kind of foggy. And I said, I think the guy's name was Phil. I said, Phil, do we want to take off into this? I mean, it's kind of soupy out here. He goes, it's not that big a deal. It'll burn off here in about an hour. We'll get above it. It's fine. It's just some low-lying clouds. We'll be fine. We'll get about 1,200 feet. You'll be right as rain. And I'm nervous already. So I reluctantly agreed to this idea. We fire up the helicopter and away we go. I'm surprised the tower let us go, but they did. So anyway, we took off, and right near it, they were doing some construction there, and there was one of those fairly tall cranes, and it had at the very top of it a flashing red and yellow light array up there to let aircraft know that this thing was there. And we're flying along kind of slow, just took off. And I look through the front windshield of the helicopter, and I see this beacon light. It was as if somebody had a neon sign that was as big as a four-story building that said, "Oh, shit," on it. We were close. I mean, damn close. Phil yanks on the stick. We're moving. We're ducking this, getting crazy out of this way. I'm completely in freak-out mode. I said, "Phil, that's it. Let's go home. I'll do the rest of this from my car. We're done." He's laughing the whole time, going, "No, it's all right." And I said, "No, we're not doing this. Let's go home." And it actually turned out to be a pretty good call that we went home, because it ultimately, the fog kind of got worse that day or that morning, and we wouldn't have been able to see anything from up there. And I came home. I never saw the life flash before my eyes or anything like that, but it was enough to just scare the crap out of me. The only other incident that really occurred during those days is when I was in a fixed-wing airplane. I actually cost a pilot his job. We were in a Cessna 152, two-seater. Great plane. Durable as hell. You can almost fly combat missions in one of these things. They're just beautifully stable aircraft. Easy to fly. Had a ball in them. Dude wants to impress his girlfriend, so he turns off the transponder and he buzzes her office in the afternoon hours. Yeah, we actually dipped down below radar in a congested air traffic area just so he can impress his girlfriend. He sees her coming out of the office building, standing into the parking lot. She's looking up at the sky waving, and he does a barrel roll with me sitting, you know, 2 inches from him to the right of him in an aircraft that's not designed to be doing that. One of the things I was studying kind of at the time was my own, you know, getting my own ticket to fly, my pilot's license. And I knew that the 152 was an aircraft that if you did something like that, chances were pretty solid that you could rip the tail off of that thing, pulling off a stunt like that. Some of you aviation guys would probably go, "Oh, hell no, the plane's, you know, that's durable, you said it yourself, you know." It's not designed for that. That's the whole point. We landed. I go into the guy's boss's office. He loses his job and he loses his ticket to fly. and thus ended my career as an airbound traffic reporter. That was the guy in the sky after about 4 years of it, part-time. During that time, I was working as a private investigator. I went to school, back to school, studied paralegal work, advanced education in a lot of law classes and stuff like that, and really boring shit. And I realized that I just couldn't sell my soul like that to become a lawyer. I just couldn't do it. And I was sitting at home, really, really contemplating my next move. We've all done that. You know what I'm talking about. When you sit there and you try and figure out, my God, what am I going to do with my life? I'm just not happy. I don't know what to do. I don't know where to go. And after about 5 years of long time waiting and wondering, my friend Tom Dees picks up the phone and he calls my mother. He tracks her down and she gives him my number and he calls me. I missed that poor guy. I really did. I mean, it had been so too far along. We just lost contact with each other. And we played catch-up on the phone for a bit. And then he hits me with this. How would you like to come to Memphis, Tennessee, and get back on television? I was reluctant, of course. It wasn't going to be like it was at WTVA, where we had all that fun, I guess. I didn't know. The industry, I'm sure, had changed quite a bit. The personalities, the prima donna aspect of it, the cutthroat competition, that's all fine. That's all part of it. That's what you do. You go with it and you do the best you can. And I thought really long and hard about it. And I, you know, for most guys, you'd be like, hell yeah, let's jump at the chance. You know, this is what you want. You want to get back into the game. Get back into TV, man. That's what that was it. That was your whole deal, right? You fell in love with it. Jump back into it. Get off the bench and swing for the fences, right? So he talked me into driving up, which I did. It's a 12-hour drive from San Antonio, Texas to Memphis, Tennessee. And I stayed up here about a week. And during that time, I had an interview with the woman who was the news director at WHBQ, Fox 13. And she offered me a job, ultimately. It was, it'd be a part-time freelance kind of thing. I'd be paid, you know, by the hour on the days that I'd be needed. But it was a foot in the door. It was a chance. That's the way I looked at it. Because you got to remember, by this point, my self-esteem had been, you know, completely run through the mill. And it didn't really do me any favors that I was more or less a functioning alcoholic. So, yeah, this is a shot. I'll take it. I packed up my shit, packed up the dog, and out we came. Funny story about that. We're driving a U-Haul to Memphis, and I locked the keys in the truck while I was putting gas in there, and I'm trying to explain to the dog how to push the button to unlock the truck. Bob didn't get it. Yeah, I had a dog named Bob. He didn't get it. I wound up having to call Papa Lock. And anyway, so I come to Memphis and I begin work at Fox 13. And it was interesting. The industry, in fact, had changed. Not so much technically. I mean, the cameras got smaller and the quality was better and things were a little more streamlined, but it was the attitudes that had really changed. The ideas that we only report news that makes us look good. We don't care about stories that are impactful, that mean something to the public. We want them to think of us as being the source. So along the way, keep in mind, I used to be a private investigator, so I wanted to fashion myself as maybe a person that could come in as an investigative reporter and be able to use the tips and tricks of the trade that I had picked up over my years as a PI and apply that into investigative journalism. Sounds like a match made in heaven, right? Turned out not so much. I had been presented a case involving a politician's drunken wife and uncovered some stuff that nobody else really had. And I was ready to really kind of take it on the air, and they wouldn't do it because they were afraid it would look bad. They didn't want any backlash from the city council or from the local politics. The machine just wasn't going to be a part of it. So they wouldn't let me go with it. On top of all of that, I happened to be downtown with a news crew when there was a building downtown that had caught fire, and I said, look, let's go live, man. It was the 9 o'clock news at this point, because, you know, it's a Fox station. I said, come on, let's go live, man. I'm here. I've got the facts. Let's go. I'm in a coat and a damn tie, for God's sake. Let's go and get in, and let's do the live shot. And they said no, because they didn't like the color of my tie. I'll let that soak in for a moment. They didn't like the color of my tie, see? And I said on the two-way, I said, I'll take off the fucking tie if it will help. There's a building on fire here, and I can give you all the facts. And you're worried about the color of my goddamn tie. Okay, I didn't go on the air that day. They wound up taking the shot static. What they call is just, it's just the, here's a live picture from what's happening down on Main and Second and blah, blah, blah. I had given them the information over the telephone, so they didn't need me. They didn't need me. They didn't want me. And quite frankly, I didn't need that bullshit either, so I walked away. It was mutual consent, mind you. We both wanted to walk away from each other. Which set me back again. Because now here I was in Memphis, Tennessee, with no prospects, nothing left. I had sold my PI business, made a couple of bucks out of that. That money was running out. I didn't have any real cash coming in from HBQ. They wound up cleaning house over there. Tom Dees is still there. And we're still very close friends. I actually was waiting tables in this town for a bit. I remember I was actually waiting on tables when Princess Diana was killed. It's just one of those things where you see a news story and it rubs you kind of the wrong way that you weren't around to cover it or to be a part of it. And then it really started to gnaw on me that television had turned into such a glib, human hand job industry. Television news, I speak of. If it wasn't scripted, if it didn't look right, it wasn't going to be a thing. It wasn't going to happen. You weren't allowed to go on the air with it. And lo and behold, it occurred to me that all this time I had forgotten my first love, my first time. That radio station in San Antonio where Mara sat there playing Steely Dan records. And to this day, I love Steely Dan. I've always loved them. And I thought, radio, wow. I didn't even think about it. My arrogance, my egotistical ass had fallen into that trap of television. That honey trap that it was always so sweet and innocent to work in TV. And glamorous and fun. And you're a celebrity. It's not all it's cracked up to be. You really see how people suck. Because they do. And I'm not going to sing like that anymore. So I sat in my apartment in Memphis. And I had a four-track cassette recorder. You'll be familiar with, those of you that are in the industry would know it. It's a Fostex. And I put together with some classic rock records I had laying around my apartment, a fake resume tape. And I took it to a station here, WMFS, I believe 92.9, and I met with a cat by the name of, I think it was Fox, it was his last name, who promptly told me that I would never make it in this business. I blew him off. That was on a Monday. Wednesday of that week, I took it to 203 Beale Street, the home of WEGR-FM. Also the home of WREC-AM. and another station which kept changing call letters so often I can't even remember them. And I walked in, I filled out an application, and I left a copy of this tape. That was on a Wednesday. The very next day, I get a phone call from Drake Hall, from Drake and Zeke. Program director and afternoon drive guy. Him and Zeke Logan did afternoons. He wanted me to come on up for an interview on Friday, the next day, which I did. I was on the air Saturday, starting my training under Wes Yahola and Gunter. He was on his way out. I wound up taking over for him, but that began my career at Rock 103. Over the next 14 years, I would go from being a part-time cat to the swinger to the production director and producer of Drive Time, Afternoon Drive Time, to being the actual Afternoon Drive Time guy with me and Dennis. Remember the Dennis and Rick show? That was me. And then working with the new morning show, which was Bad Dog and Rick in the morning. And this is where I will stop at this point. Part two of this episode will cover all of that. The salad days of WEGR, at least for me. I know they had a bigger heyday before I got there. That was before my time, I can't help it. But while I was there in those early days, boy, howdy, would we have fun. And I will share with you those fun stories. And I will set the cast of characters in place and set the table for the main course, which will be the third and final episode of this series, which is about Bad Dog and the death of FM radio under my feet. It will get you up to speed, and it will be the final words I have to say about those days at Clear Channel. The two upcoming episodes, I will tell you right now, are going to be difficult for me to do. I may have a therapist in the studio with me who will be silent and to make sure that I don't completely freak out, because I'm going to be walking through some dark doors. I know some of you in the industry are going to go, "Oh, you pussy. You didn't live it. You didn't see it. You didn't undergo it." Those procedures, those exacting procedures where they were firing shots through this crowd of people, the bloodletting, the loss, the destruction of the industry, the loss of friendships, loss of lots of family members, and death. I will cover it all. That'll be over the next 2 weeks. So, that's what's coming up. Here's what's coming up on the next edition from Radioland.
It wasn't really hard work at all. In fact, it was quite enjoyable because it allowed me to turn the production studio into, at least in my head, instead of a place just to lay down sound and piece something together, what it was a studio where you could have, in essence, a lump of clay and turn it into whatever it is that you wanted. And so it was. That was my lot. I was going to be the production director, and I was going to be the producer for Drake and Zeke, and I still did my weekend stuff, and that was that. Had somehow managed to survive cancer a couple of times. Good for him. Had about 6 feet of his colon taken out of him at one point. Or as John used to say, he's the only guy I know that had an asshole transplant and rejected him. They honestly earned the reputation and the name of being called the Evil Empire because they were evil. Dennis and I would hold down the afternoons for 3 years.
Radio Memphis is an internet broadcasting service provided by PirateRadioStudios.com, Memphis, Tennessee, USA.
Just as a reminder, I'll be doing the next episode of which you just already heard a cut of, 2 and 3 together, and we'll have it all up there for you, and you'll be able to listen to it and comment on it if you'd like. That may be the last time I'll actually use the comment sections. It may fall on deaf ears, it may not. It may piss off some of you. I hope it does. Some of you will probably be sickened by what you will hear. Some of it will be laugh out loud funny in a very tragic way. But there's that. Thank you once again for being such a supporter of this podcast. Tell all of your friends about it, if you would. If you like what you heard, it would really do me a lot of good to share it. Share it on your social media, Facebook, Twitter, wherever it is that you go. Just remember rickcheddar.blogspot.com. You can find me on Podbean. Search my name in Google. It'll tell you what's going on. Spell it correctly, if you would. RICCHETTER. It's pronounced Rick Cheddar. And that's who I am. And this has been From Radioland.